Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
People who do bad things sometimes believe they're doing it for the best of motives.
For the very first time, the greatest minds in criminology have come together to dissect the psyches of some of the world's most prolific serial killers. These forensic psychiatrists, psychologists, and pathologists have an incredible depth of knowledge and often first-hand insight into these killers, helping us to understand what makes a monster. The following interview with Dr. Adrian Needs was recorded in August 2019 for Crime and Investigations TV series Making a Monster. A forensic psychologist at the University of Portsmouth, Dr. Needs spent 14 years working in Her Majesty's Prison Service, rising to the rank of Principal Psychologist. Dr. Needs has worked in high-security prisons such as Wakefield, Full Sutton, and Hull Special Unit. Here, Dr. Needs discusses Robert Maudsley. Although he has not directly worked with the serial killer, Dr. Needs' insight complements that of Professor Bob Johnson, who worked directly with Maudsley and is featured in a previous episode. Caution, the subject matter of this interview contains graphic descriptions and is often very disturbing.
I think something that stands out with Robert Maudsley is the extreme nature of his early environment. I think one of the consequences of being locked up is that, well, he could probably only contrast it with how his life had been before his parents had reclaimed him from the children's home. So he would have missed the, well, more normal elements that he'd experienced in the home, because he was with his siblings there, I believe. But in its place, he would have had an existence of sheer, well, monotony punctuated with terror. There is an account where he describes living in fear of the door being unlocked. And then his father would come in and he'd be beaten with an object such as a poker or a belt, or in one case, I think a .22 rifle was broken over his back. And then his father would leave with, laughter, it seems. And he must have regarded himself, even in those days, as a real prisoner. He must have tried to figure what this was all about. He would certainly have had a lot of time to ruminate, to think in that kind of impoverished environment. And then apparently he was only brought out to try and take part in a charade whereby his aunties or welfare officer were told about how great he was getting on and how happy his life was. To have been forced to participate in that really must have made him question any sort of sense of reality, or must have questioned further any sense that other people cared or could be trusted. I think it's very likely that the abuse and the limitations of his life led him to feel very angry. And also the fact that, apart from the abuse, the fact that he was taken away from the children's home the orphanage where he'd lived the first few years of his life. That must have seemed like a betrayal. He must have wondered why that had taken place, and, well, he must have wondered why he was being subjected to such dreadful treatment now. So I think that would have left a legacy of anger, and often tied to anger is a sense of injustice. Maybe a sense of wanting to turn the tables on an abusive world as well. I think the years with the nuns in the orphanage certainly seems to have been a positive influence on his social development. I mean, there are some accounts of him in later life, or now, actually having the capacity for ordinary, normal social interaction and actually being quite engaging to speak to. I think that area really developed initially through those positive contacts in the orphanage. He had a settled, relatively stable existence in the orphanage, and then these two characters who he's had nothing to do with for many years, probably can't remember at all, would then come. And yes, it must have been quite difficult for him to make sense of that, especially being told that they were his family, when he regarded the nuns as his real family. It must have been very difficult for him to make sense of going to the abusive environment. There would have been a very strong contrast with the more settled environment, the more nurturing environment of the children's home. And that's combined with the fact that, apart from the deprivation of the children's home, he was subjected to this very punitive, abusive lifestyle, and very restricted in what he can do, what he could do and what he had, and living with the ever-present threat of beatings, which he knew were going to come. So there must have been a really strong contrast between his existence when he went back to his parents, the existence he'd known at the children's home. I think there may be an element of truth in the comment that he made about if he'd killed his parents back in, I think it was 1970, he wouldn't have gone on to kill. I mean, it's one of those unknowables, really. At best, it can only be highly speculative. However, if he had, in a sense, got it out of his system, this really strong anger and sense of injustice towards his parents, given the right conditions, following that, it might have been possible for his social development to, well, to continue upon more normal lines. Issues of opportunity might well have played a role in him not killing his parents and killing others instead, in that it seemed that the original offence did arise from a particular situational context where there was a trigger. And he was working as a rent boy. He was heavily into drugs and so forth, but apparently his client on one occasion showed him some photos of children that he'd abused. And I guess, why would somebody do that? Well, possibly there was an element of gloating about it, almost pride that the person had inflicted this suffering on children. And that must have had a very strong resonance with Robert. And it seems that at that point he just lost it and really mounted quite a sustained and very serious attack till the person was killed. And after that, he didn't really have the opportunity to get at his parents because he went to Broadmoor, and as a result of things that happened there, he went to Wakefield, and he's remained in the prison system, largely in solitary confinement ever since. It's his first murder in custody. I think took place in an environment where he was cut off from the staff who couldn't intervene. In fact, I think it's been reported that at one point him and Cheeseman, who he committed the offence with, actually raised the body so that so that staff would be able to see it. So it's almost a kind of taunt against the staff. It's showing what he could do, an exercise of power to that extent. But also when you've got two individuals, both with violent propensities, they can egg each other on. And also in 9 hours, I think there was some suggestion that things might have started off fairly low-key, but escalated over the course of the 9 hours, with the violence getting more and more extreme until eventually you move from torture to, I believe, breaking a plastic spoon and sticking it through the victim's ear to the brain, which gave rise to the untrue reports of cannibalism. People who do bad things sometimes believe they're doing it for the best of motives, and often with anger, even displaced anger, there can be a sense of moral righteousness, a sense that the victim has done something wrong or the victim's a bad person, and that somehow justifies them perpetrating assault, torture, and eventually death.
Deemed too dangerous to serve his whole life tariff in a normal cell, Robert Maudsley spends all but 1 hour a day locked in solitary confinement. His cell, nicknamed the Glass Cage, was purpose-built in the basement of Wakefield Prison. Maudsley was first convicted of the murder of John Farrell and sent to Broadmoor Hospital, where he and fellow inmate David Cheeseman killed another, David Francis. It was on conviction that he was sent to Wakefield Prison, where a year later he would kill Salney Darwood and William Roberts in the same day.
Oh, it seems that moving to Wakefield would have been seen as a retrograde step, an impoverished environment, and also arguably out of step with the motivations behind the offence that he had committed in the secure hospital. To go to a mainstream Victorian prison, it certainly wouldn't have seemed to him as anything like progress, and the environment probably would have been relatively austere and limited compared to what he was used to in the secure hospital. So it could be that if he'd been retained in what should be a therapeutic environment of a hospital, it might not have happened. It also raises the question, did he see the offences that he committed in Wakefield as a way of getting out of Wakefield? A kind of protest, a sign that he's not going to settle there. Maybe he thought it was going to get him removed back to a secure hospital, but actually all it did was mean that he was more closely confined than ever. Well, I worked at Wakefield Prison not many years after, and it was a Victorian maximum security prison, dispersal prison it was called in those days. And facilities were limited, and they still had slopping out. You didn't have your own toilet in your cell, basically. Things like televisions, you'd have two or three per wing of about 140 prisoners, and at any given time, at least one wasn't working. And you'd only watch in a TV room, which is rather a threatening place, because wherever you sat, somebody would say, "That's so-and-so's chair." And the food wasn't fantastic, it must be said. You had quite a few staff who'd worked there for a long time, and they were fairly local, and they had no aspirations for promotion and that sort of thing. So sometimes it was talked about as being full of the dinosaurs. On the other hand, there were also a lot of very dedicated and professional staff there who, I think, represented the best of the prison officer tradition. There were people who had a down-to-earth good sense and good humour, and they were usually very good at defusing difficult situations and A lot of them had ex-forces backgrounds. They were quite good at sort of geeing people along, or maybe giving them a bit of support if they were down. And they were very good at what used to be called man management. But certainly there were limitations at that time, as there were, I think, throughout the prison system. This was in the years before the Wolf Report in the early 90s, where conditions improved significantly, where integral sanitation, you know, toilets in cells became much more the norm, for example. So conditions weren't great, but they weren't too sort of, they weren't awful in the sense of being abusive or completely squalid or that sort of thing, but certainly compared to the rest of the prison system at the time, they weren't too squalid, they weren't inhumane, and actually some prisoners quite liked Wakefield because they felt safer than they did at other places. They felt that the staff were in control. And another thing that I came to appreciate more subsequently was, after Wakefield, I worked at Full Sutton, and there the architecture was built upon a sort of 1960s small is beautiful design, whereby they had wings built around courtyards. Now, you've got wings built on courtyards, you've got blind spots at every corner, you've got stairwells, and all sorts of places where prisoners could be intimidated or, well, actually the victim of violence by other prisoners. At Wakefield, despite the fact that, of course, Maudsley did kill twice there, generally speaking, visibility was a whole lot better, in that virtually anywhere on one of these big cathedral-like wings could be seen from virtually anywhere else. And a lot of prisoners, by and large, felt a lot safer in that kind of environment. Also, I mean, some prisoners didn't like the fact that there were a lot of sex offenders at Wakefield. Wakefield had quite a good record of being able to integrate sex offenders on normal locations on the wings, whereas in other places they'd have been, well, locked up for their own protection. And there were so many, and they were dealt with successfully, you know, most of the time, that people that wouldn't have felt safe elsewhere did feel that it was a more safe environment to be in. Now, okay, that's not foolproof or infallible, as the murder of the two prisoners by Maudsley showed. But apart from the fact that he might have taken exception to the sheer number of sex offenders on normal occasion there, it wasn't regarded as too bad a place. I mean, it's difficult to answer the question of his precise motivation and why he committed the offences at that time, you know, without talking to him about it, but it seems that quite likely that he was at Wakefield, he didn't really want to be there. He was probably surrounded with people that had committed the sorts of crimes that might have reminded him of the abuse that he'd suffered. Also, I think he was carrying around with him a lot of anger because of the past, and maybe wanted to find expression to that. Maybe he thought that if he did this, committed the murders, then he would be sent back to the secure hospital or to another location, anywhere but Wakefield. I think he did on the day in question make two paper coffins and put human hair in them, which seems to have almost a ritual significance to it. So maybe this was part of him psyching himself up to do what he did. I think it's likely that he wanted to have as much impact as possible. And there doesn't seem to have been entirely a loss of control involved. Now, quite extreme levels of violence seem to have been used on both victims, but by all accounts, when he'd killed the second, he went to the wing office and handed over his blade and that's when he said that there'd be two less for the roll call that day. Now, it could be that he'd got the pent-up aggression and anger out of his system by the time he'd killed the second. But given the fact that there was clear forethought, he'd made the paper coffins with the hair in and that sort of thing, it seems that there were at least elements of, trying to achieve something, what's usually referred to as instrumental motivation, as well as any emotional motivation behind it. It's a difficult question to answer and ultimately unknowable whether he would have committed those murders if he'd known the consequences. Certainly, if it was the case that part of the motivation was to get himself removed from Wakefield, if he'd have known that it wasn't going to achieve that, in fact, it was going to put him in a worse situation, that might have acted as an inhibitor.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I think there's definitely an irony in his present situation, where he is in solitary confinement and his existence is quite limited. And there are certainly parallels with his earlier life when he was confined by his parents. I suppose the difference is that he doesn't get somebody coming in really severely beating him. But I suppose the reason that he is kept in solitary confinement is that he did show 40 years ago that he's rather unsafe to have on normal occasion. However, I do understand that he also, over the years, has spent some time at special units such as Parkhurst and Wood Hill, and I wonder really why he was moved back from those to, in effect, where he started, at the cage at Wakefield. And I did read an account by one of the detectives who'd been involved in the case, in which the detective said that actually he seems quite a thoughtful, fairly engaging person, and clearly with a high level of intelligence and quite developed cultural interests. So, especially given what we know about the profoundly negative effects of solitary confinement, there's a lot of research being done in America where it's not so unusual. I do wonder whether it's strictly necessary and whether just for humanitarian reasons we should consider him being in an environment where there are more facilities, more things for him to do, and where there can be more contact with other people and perhaps even some therapeutic engagement, continuing with some work that he's done occasionally in the past where he's found it beneficial to be able to talk to people about his earlier life and the way things have developed. And certainly he's getting older now, by all accounts. He's not in good health. And I think maybe now is the time to start trying to introduce him to, less impoverished conditions. And I know a popular view is to say that, somebody who's killed like that should throw away the key, but I think his situation is rather different to a lot of serial killers, both in the nature of his victims, and this is not to discount the seriousness of what he's done, because the victims probably still have families and that sort of thing, but seeing things in the overall context of his life and the circumstances of his offending, I wonder whether we as a civilized society ought to be thinking about helping him a bit more in his last, what's realistically are going to be his last few years. And it does raise the question, does society owe that to him after the way society let him down when he was a child?
In the next episode of Making a Monster, The Tapes, we have an interview with forensic pathologist Dr. Richard Shepherd. And you can watch Crime and Investigation's Making a Monster, the TV show, Mondays at 9 p.m. with the episode focusing on Robert Maudsley now available to watch on demand. If you haven't already, please leave a review on your podcast app or get in touch on social media using hashtag MakingAMonster. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this latest episode. And finally, to find out more on the series, crimeandinvestigation.co.uk has profiles on all the serial killers featured in the show, alongside information on all our latest TV and podcast series. Making a Monster, The Tapes features interviews recorded by Monster Films for the Crime and Investigation TV series and was voiced by me, Cherry Healy, produced by Sam Pearson and Chloe Frost, with editing by Joel Porter.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.